Our main speaker tonight is Bob D.
My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm sober only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, The Ability to Remain Reasonably Sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in the primary purpose of helping other drunks and trying to forget myself, and consequently, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. And that is the big miracle in my life. Unfortunately, sometimes I take it for granted. I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank Cynthia for inviting me. And Adrian came out to Kennedy Airport to pick me up and circled around. And he's going to rush me back there. So you can't thank me after the meeting, which is, will delight some of you. Because I'm heading across the pond as soon as within the next couple hours. So, but I'm delighted to be here. This is an enthusiastic group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a doers group, and I'm alive today as a result of the example of doers in AA. I don't need the example of selfish, self-seeking, self-serving people. I do that naturally. I needed the example of doers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm an alcoholic. When I say that, I'm not saying that, it doesn't mean, it's not because I have emotional problems that I've had at times. I was one time diagnosed as clinically depressed, another time diagnosed as free-floating anxiety and panic disorder. All of it's really amounts to being a deep thinker. But that doesn't make me an alcoholic. I had a childhood with really good parents, so I was burdened by love. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. Fact that I fell into some guys that had a bunch of drugs and got addicted to something for a period of time, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because of an abnormal reaction to alcohol that only occurs in people that have alcoholism. There's a lot of people come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they identify with the neurosis, they identify with the feelings and the problems with the relationships and all that other stuff, but they can do something I can't do. And the sad thing, because they can do it, they don't want to do it, but they could actually drink. And God, I hate people like that, Jesus. But I can't drink because every time I drink alcohol, something happens to me that only happens to people with alcoholism. As the effect from the alcohol starts to hit me, I break out in an irresistible yearning for more. I have always had that. I've never once in all the years that I was drinking did I not have that. I've never been in a guy's basement doing lines, smoking reefer, drinking wine, or been in a bar with my buddies doing shots and beers and shooting pool and had somebody say, Bob, would you like another one? I've never had the experience of looking at them and thinking to myself, no, I'm good, thanks. Never. And that defines me as a person with alcoholism. Now, what defines me as a person with chronic alcoholism, it's not just that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, is that I also have an abnormal reaction to abstinence that eventually drives me so insane, I'm seeking medication for my abstinence. Right? And what happens when I get sober, and I couldn't see this time and time again, is I just start to get weird. I don't think I'm weird. Primarily, it looks like you are, but I get weird, and I'm restless, Silkworth says, irritable, discontent. I don't really know it. This restlessness is so vague. It's just that inability to feel settled anywhere the way other people seem to be settled into life. I'm irritable, but I'm not going to admit to myself I'm irritable. First of all, irritable people irritate me. I am not irritable. What I am is every time I stop drinking and the fog clears, I'm a guy who can see very clearly how stupid people are. Oh, my God. It's a gift. Everywhere I look, I see stupid people. Because I'm restless, I want to tell them, which makes abstinence a lonely business. And I'm chronically malcontent. I can get the best girlfriend, the best job, the best, nicest Harley, get in the band I want to be in. I can get everything I can acquire and bring into my vacancy zone, everything that I believe is going to make a difference. And from the moment of acquisition, the shine of it just starts to wear off. And as my grand sponsor, Chuck Chamberlain, used to say, we eventually get to a point sober where you can no longer find anything to put between you and you. And that's where guys like me with 15, 20, 30, we had a woman 43 and a half years commit suicide last year who had everything out here. But if no matter how good you can get it out here, if it ain't no good in here, I'm telling you, it ain't no good. And so I'm driven by a vacancy that I don't even understand. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm acquiring things all the time, and nothing seems to really make much difference to me. And so I drink. And I go back to drinking, because drinking is the only thing that I ever found that seemed to help for a while. I mean, five shots. Alcohol, you know, it's a funny thing. Our book says that we have this spiritual malady. And I think alcohol is the most, at one time, the most immediate and dynamic treatment for the spiritual malady I have ever found. I remember I was in Pennsylvania. I was working in this factory. God, I hated that job. I hated those people. They were stupid people. I hated everything about it, but I had to have the job because I had to have the paycheck, because without the paycheck, I can't get the medicine. Without the medicine, I do not do sober well. I need to be able to drink. And so I can't drink on the job because they caught me once. And so I go to work every day and I just tough it out with those people I can't stand. And I get to the end of that shift and that buzzer goes off. I'm the first guy at that time clock and I punch out in like an arrow. I cross the street into that bar. That bartender knows me. He's got two double shots of 100 proof waiting for me and a beer back. I go in there, I throw down that first double shot of 100 proof. You ever notice the first drink always tastes like hope? It's always hope. And then I throw down that second one, I'm sipping on the beer, and those people I can't stand that I work with are now coming into that bar. And I'm looking at them, and I've got two double shots in me and a half a beer, and I watching them walk in and thinking, you know, they're not bad people. A couple more double shots. I'm shooting pool with some of them. After a while, we're planning our vacations together, you know? I mean, after about 20 shots of whiskey, I'm saying things to them like, I love you, man. I'll die for you. And then I go back to work the next day and hate them all over again, you know? It's because alcohol at the early days of my drinking lifted my spirit up and set me free and enabled me to love and be connected and all of that. But I'm in a grip of a progressive illness, and what that means is as time goes by, I can't seem to get that effect much anymore, and it seems to bleed out. And I don't know why. I don't know why at the last couple years of my drinking, I drink in depression. I drink in this horrid loneliness. I would drink, and as long as I was still conscious, I would still be plagued with the remorse and the shame of who I've become and what I've done. I don't know why it stops working for guys like me, but when it does, life's unbearable. The book talks about getting to a place where you can't imagine life with it, not like that, not this pathetic crying jag drinking. This feeling sorry for myself, holed up somewhere, seeking oblivion, drinking. I can't imagine life like that. And yet I can't imagine life without it either, because I'm so weird when I'm not drunk. I feel like I'm doing time. And so I start and I can't stop, and I burn my life to the ground. I stop and I can't stay stopped. And abstinence is horrible, and drinking has become horrible. And so in 1978, I tried to kill myself because I was in a trap I couldn't spring. Here's the funny thing. I'd been around and exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous by this time for many, many years. I'm too selfish for AA. I won't do anything that's inconvenient. I won't do anything that's not my idea. I won't do anything I don't feel like doing. And I'm selfish and self-centered to the extreme. Our book says that we're extreme examples of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. Now, what's that mean? That what that means is you don't get this, but okay. Here's the high level on the scale for normal people and self-centeredness and self-will. See that dot up there in the stratosphere? That's Bob. That's me, right? I'm an extreme example. Yet I don't think so. You could have put me in a lie detector and asked me, are you selfish in self-centeredness? Well, no, I'm not. I care too much. That's the problem. I told my sponsor one time, I said, I was really having a bad day early sobriety. I said, you know, I'm just sensitive. And he said, sensitive? Sensitive people are sensitive to other people's feelings. You're only sensitive to your own. We call that self-obsessed. And so I was unsponsorable. I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, just can't tell him much. And when you can't listen to anyone or follow anybody's directions except yourself, you are a closed system. And if you're a closed system, nothing changes. That's why in the latter years of alcoholism, it kind of feels like you're stuck. I'd end up back in Alcoholics Anonymous with people I was newcomers with them 2 years before, and they're doing very well. And it's like you can see the promised land, you just can't get there because you won't take the actions to take you there. See, and it's not AA, as my dear friend Frank Honeycutt used to say, recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is not for those who need it. We all have people we love that are dying of this disease. They never get it. It's not even for those who want it. I've talked to men in front of the detox sobbing uncontrollably, telling me with tears of sincerity how much they want this, and they never get it because it's only for those who do it. When I was brand new, a guy came up to me after a meeting and he said, kid, I think you need to take step three. And I said to him, I said, I can't take step three. I don't believe in God. He said, you don't have to believe in God. I said, well, that's what it says. Believe, came to believe, made it, you know. He said, listen, kid, if you'll turn your will and your life over this chair, and he points to a chair in the Olano Club. He said, I guarantee you an instantaneous miracle. So I said, oh, what the hell? All right, I turn my will and my life over the chair. And he gets a big smile on his face. He says, then your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And I didn't even get mad. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right, yeah. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been a process of self-reduction. And little did I know as I reduced me that God would start to bloom in my life. That I was in the way. I was too full of myself to have you there. I was sober a while, 6 months, I think, before I realized there were anybody else in AA except me. You know what I mean? It's like you're all cardboard cutouts I'd share my problems at or something, you know? I thought my name was, does anyone want to share? You know, I was so narcissistic, you know, just I wanted to make every meeting I went to all about me, and nothing changed. And my sponsor started pushing me into 12-step work when I was brand new. I didn't want to do 12-step work. I'd worked actually as a therapist for a while. I was really good at it too until they fired me for being drunk in the clinic. They don't like that. But I had a head full of information. And so when he's telling me he wants me to do 12-step work, I tried to argue with him a little bit. I was committed to do what he said, but I was trying to, some of these people in AA, they may be sober a long time, but you kind of know they're not that bright. So you want to kind of bring some new information to them. And I was explaining to him that I understood why he wanted me to do 12-step work. Yeah, I know that's what we do here. It's like Amway, you know, we just do that. And I get it. But for God's sakes, don't you think I should work on me for a while? And when I said that, he rears back and he says, work on you. You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. When he said that, I thought, you know, I have done quite enough. I used to come up here to New York City. I was in therapy with a guy named Albert Ellis, the rational. I mean, I was in therapy with one of the contemporaries of Alan Watts and Fritz Perl. For God's sakes, if I could have been fixed, I'd have been fixed. I mean, I was hypnotized one time. It didn't help me to stay sober, but to this day, when the doorbell rings, I have to fight the urge to bark like a dog. I made that up. That's not true. But I was hypnotized. You're pushing me into taking actions that I don't believe in. And what you're doing is you're getting me to show up, even though I'm basically selfish and self-centered and self-absorbed and self-focused and self-concerned. You're repositioning me in life like someone would position themselves that wasn't that much like that. And I had no idea that I was going to catch something, what we call grace here. I was about a year sober, and I was a co-GSR. The GSR got drunk, so all of a sudden I'm a GSR. And I wasn't supposed to be until I was 2 years, and I went to the area assembly, and I heard a trustee give a talk, and they said something I've never forgot. They said that they believed that 5% of the actual fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous did 95% of the 12-step work and the service. And then they said that that 5%, as long as they remained a 5%er, never, ever drank again. And I thought, man, that's it. I want to be a 5%er. I started to understand what it says in the book when it says those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely, completely is like, more than half, completely give themselves to this simple program. And I was the guy, and I was in a group of people that AA was first, and I followed them, and they were big on service and big on helping others and 12-step work and amends, and a sponsor that would not cut me any break when it came to amends. Even if I would go to someone and exude spirituality, and they told me I didn't have to pay him, he'd make me pay him anyway. I mean, oh, just no compromise. And I started to become different in the world. I started to be relieved of the bondage of self. I started to intermittently have periods of a freedom that was not that much different from the freedom I found in the early days of my drinking, when you're not drunk, but just drunk. You know, that just drunk and you're free. You know what I mean? You can come out and play. And what that was, and I never knew this, is that alcohol had relieved me of the bondage of self. See, the very basic nature of my sickness is when I'm sober, I just get me right up on me, and I can't get me off of me. And alcohol used to bring me up off of me and set me free. And the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to do the same thing. The bad news is that it doesn't do them as quickly as 5 shots of tequila. Yet I got very lucky, because 5 shots of tequila, it just made me go on a crying jag. It didn't set me free anymore, and I knew it. I didn't want to know it. The last 2-3 years I drank, it was pathetic, because I would hope against hope that I'm going to jumpstart that party. I'm going to get back to those good old days. My God, I got to get back there. And for that to collapse, I finally became an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I lost all hope within the one arena that I wanted to hope the most, and that was to get free and to get ease and comfort and relief. And I knew the party was over. And when the party's over and you get to a place where drinking is horrible and not drinking is horrible, and you can't even seem to be able to kill yourself, there's not a whole lot left except Alcoholics Anonymous. It truly is the last house on the block. There's nowhere to go from here. There's no referrals somewhere else. Your sponsor's not going to say, well, I don't think AA is enough for you. We want you to go over. No. Matter of fact, I sponsor a couple of psychiatrists, and I've sponsored clergy. All the people in psychology and religion who have a drinking problem, they have to come here. There's nowhere for them to go. This is really God's given last house on the block for us. And I found my seat here. I've held on to it. I've done whatever's necessary to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though I'm sober a long time, I still go to a lot of meetings. I still do 12-step work. I have several commitments every week in my home group. I say yes. Sometimes it's really inconvenient. But I got to tell you something. In the big picture, in hindsight, the more inconvenient the things you do in Alcoholics Anonymous, the better, the more it changes you. And I get to be wrong. You ever had the experience? Somebody wants you to go to a meeting with him. You go, oh, I don't like that meeting. I don't want to go to that. There's a good movie. I don't want to go to that. Not that. No, I don't want to go to that meeting. And you go to that meeting. Oh, my God, that was the best meeting I've ever been to in my life. Because I think our recovery is built on being wrong. It starts in that fourth step. When you list all those resentments, all the people you have cases built against, all the judgments. And then in the bottom of page 66, top of 67, start to process it through that, looking at it from an entirely different angle, realizing how the person who'd harmed you is perhaps like you, and you see it through their eyes, and all of a sudden, oh my God, I was wrong about my mother and father. I never looked at it through their eyes. I was too selfish. I was too self-centered. My sister, I was so wrong about her, and all those bosses, and all those girlfriends, and all the, my God, I've even wrong about the drug dealers. Oh my God, I'm wrong about everything. And you're coming out of that just like I'm not right about nothing. And I have never grown spiritually by being right, but I have grown a lot from my willingness to be wrong, because being right is the main muscle of the ego. And you can measure my distance from you, my distance from God, my distance from the decision in step three, and my distance from my own surrender by the amount of opinions I have in my life and judgments and how right I am. If I could capture and hold on to the spiritual position in the tenth tradition, I would be a very happy person. Imagine having no opinions. Just like something terrible happens. Oh, Bob, that's terrible. Really? I don't know. The market crashed. You lost 300 grand. Oh, so, you know. Right? You'd be bulletproof. It is in my defensiveness and the things that I allow to threaten me that comes the conflict. I was working with a guy. He's coming up. We're having his 30th AA birthday. One of the guys I sponsor next month. And he went through a bad patch of road a couple years ago. I mean, really, it was frightening to him. He was afraid he was going to lose everything. His marriage, his job, his house. And he did lose a bunch of stuff. But he survived. He came out the other end. And he was okay. He was doing okay. He was the anxiety had dissipated. He knew he was going to be all right. And I said to him, I said, man, that was a bad patch of road you went through. And he said, oh, man, I'm telling you, worst one in all the years I was sober. I said, I know that. I said, you know, you're sober long enough now. I think I can tell you, if you're willing to listen, I think you're ready to hear the secret. He said, what secret? I said, I can give you the secret on how you never, ever, ever again have to experience that anxiety that comes in the fear of not getting your way. He said, really? I said, are you ready? He said, yeah. I said, okay, it's very simple. Don't have a way. He looked at me, oh, that wouldn't work. Yes, it would. That is the essence of the decision in step three, is to not have a way. I caught something here. I didn't want to. I didn't even know I would. I caught a thing called grace. And I caught an experience with God. And it's odd because I was an atheist when I got here. Not a real atheist. I've known some real atheists. I tell you, you have to be very religious about your atheism to be a good atheist. I'm not a real atheist. I'm a wannabe atheist because I'm afraid of God. I'm afraid if there's a God, I'm in a lot of trouble. Oh, Jesus. A God who can see in the dark, read my mind. Bad deal. And you guys told me to just to forget everything I knew and start positioning myself in life as if there was. He said, we want you to, we know you don't believe, and that's perfectly all right, but we want you to start showing up as it, it's the way someone would show up that was willing to believe. Not that believes, but is willing to believe. And I thought, well, okay. And they had me do crazy little things, pray in the morning. I don't believe in God. I felt like a hypocrite. The guy said, you've been a hypocrite all your life. Just do it. Just do it. Do it. They started, when I was in trouble and I'd feel angst and fear and during the day, they said, just turn your attention, your consciousness towards whatever you don't is there that you don't even believe in and ask for help. And I started doing that and something started happening. And I started the process of self-reduction to move out all the stuff that's between me and God in steps 4 through 9, all the judgments, all the unmade amends, all the separation, all of that. And I started to catch something that's amazing. You know, I think that this power in the universe that loves me has always waited for my availability. The problem is I've got too much of me in the way. And what started happening in my life is I started to show up as if I really trusted this power. Because it started to have a track record with me that was undeniable. And I didn't know what it was. I just knew that there was something in the fabric of the universe that seemed to love me. And I started to position. And I think this thing called grace is very much like the wind. When I was a little kid, me and another guy smoked a bunch of pot and stole a little sailfish boat and went out on this lake, and we didn't know what we were doing, so we ended up upside down in the lake because that wind had the, if you don't know how to set the sail and handle a sailboat, that wind will tip you over, it'll push you backwards, it'll mess you up. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done is you've taught me how to set the sail to catch the wind. And where's it going to take you? I don't know. But so far, it's been really good. It's been really good. See, I know something now. I have a track record with God. I know that God's vision of Bob is much better than my vision of Bob. I would rather take what he gives me than get what I want, because what he offers to give me is always better. Chamberlain used to say it all the time. He says, only one thing worse than not getting your way, and that's getting it. Because it's like a dog chasing a car. What does he do when he catches it? I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, and so I've come to trust God. And I love that. I have a friend, I'll say this and I'll shut up. I have a friend that's a pilot. He told me a story one time. He was flying a little plane and he said he hit a wind shear and it was bad. It was really bad. He said, when you hit a wind shear, often if it hits you right, it'll throw you into what's called a tailspin. And you think you're going to die. You're spinning out of control towards the ground, and it's the most frightening thing. He said, every instinct in you is to pull back on that rudder, but they had taught him that if he did that, he would crash the plane for sure and die. That what he must do was something very contrary to every feeling in him. He must push the stick forward and then let it go. And he said that those planes are made by their creator to right themselves. And I think my life's like that. Dr. Paul, he said it really well when he said he was amazed how his, when he'd be out helping people in the interim, his problems would just die of neglect. What if you found out one day that every problem you've been anguishing over and suffering over, what if you found that it didn't exist, and if it ever did came into reality, it's because you worried it in there? What if your life was self-correcting? and in divine order for the ultimate goal of your connectedness. And the book says, we believe God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. It's just a shame that we don't. Thanks for listening.